Hey guys, it's Albert. We're going to cover all the big news of the first week of free agency, the trades, the signings, all that stuff. You're going to get it all here. Then we bring in a special guest to talk about the Tom Brady situation one more time. And as always, we wrap things up with a six-pack of your Twitter questions. Let's go. All right, welcome in. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. Quarantine week two. I hope all of you guys are staying safe, socially isolating yourself from everybody else, all of that. And as a disclaimer here, if you guys hear the Aussie in the background, and I think he's just freaking out right now, a five-year-old, a three-year-old, a six-month-old, or a grown woman, that is a product of where we're all at in this country right now, which is there's no school, more people are at home. People are cooped up a little bit, so if there's more background noise, just consider that kind of like the ambiance of the time that we're all in. There's plenty of NFL news to hit this week amid everything that's been going on in this country. You know, we had free agency, we had trades, the draft's still kind of looming out there in the distance, and we're going to address all of it here. We're going to start with the takeaways, and my first takeaway for this week, I'm going to give you some reasons why the Brady-Bucks marriage can work. Now, we know some of the things that are going to be different, right? Like, so he's 43 years old. That's obviously a factor. He's going in and playing in an offense that he hasn't played in before. That, to me, obviously brings up different questions when he's been in one offense for 20 years. This is obviously a new program, too, and that creates, I think, an adjustment as well. But I want to give you guys reasons why this could work, what reasons why this will work. And I've got right in front of me five of them that I think from doing the reporting that I did, and you guys can learn all about the pursuit of Tom Brady by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in this week's MMQB at the site. Through my reporting on how this whole thing went down, I give you five reasons that I think that this really could wind up working. Reason number one, I think there's real investment from Tom Brady to the Bucs. And what I mean by that, just look at some of the nuance in what he's going to do. A, he's planning on being at OTAs if there are OTAs, and maybe there won't be OTAs, but he's planning on being at OTAs. That shows he's all in a way that maybe he wasn't the last couple of years in New England, or didn't have to be the last couple of years in New England with the amount of institutional knowledge that he has. And then B, he's committed to learning their terminology. Now, this is a little thing, right? But when Peyton Manning went to Denver, like there was sort of a melding of the terminology. And when Bruce Arians and Jason Light and those guys talked to Tom Brady last week, you know, they went through this, and you know, Arians' feeling was it's probably easier for 20, 25 guys who may be average learners to stick with what they're doing and have you learn something new than it would be for all of them to have something, have all of them learn something new and you stick to what you do. And so I think the fact that he's planning to be at OTA is the fact that he's going to learn their terminology. Those aren't small things to me. That shows Brady's investment in the program. Number two, there's investment in the staff in the quarterback position. And if you look at why it worked for Peyton Manning, again, I hate to use that example, but it's the most relevant one here. If you look at why it worked for Peyton Manning in Denver, he had a group of young coaches around him. Mike McCoy, Adam Gase, Brian Callahan, Jim Bob Cooter. There was like this think tank around him. And they haven't done that yet in Tampa. But what they do have is a bunch of coaches who looked at Brady as a quarterback, looked at last year's tape, looked at the 2018 tape, made the decision, this guy's worth pursuing. And there are four coaches in that group that all, to varying degrees, have a lot of experience with the quarterback position. Clyde Christensen, Tom Moore, Bruce Arians, and Byron Leftwich. Byron Leftwich has coached it. He played it at the NFL level. Bruce Arians, we don't need to go into all the experience he has, but he's worked with a lot of accomplished quarterbacks. Ben Roethlisberger, Peyton Manning, Andrew Luck, Carson Palmer. So obviously he's got the experience. And then both Tom Moore and Clyde Christensen actually worked for an extended period of time with Peyton Manning. And so all of those guys looked at Brady on tape, saw a player they think can still play, so they're all invested in this. And I think that there's at least a skeleton there of a group of coaches who have an idea of what it's going to take to coach Tom Brady. And I think what's interesting about that to me is, you know, you always hear this from guys who coached Peyton or Tom. You have to have everything. You have to have all your ducks in a row. Because if you're going to present a Tom Brady or a Peyton Manning with something new, then you're going to have to like have all the basics covered. And you can't go into a meeting with him and just throw a bunch of stuff at him. You can't waste his time. You can't throw a bunch of stuff at him that he already knows. And because some of these guys worked in that environment with Peyton, it's not going to be new for them going into this sort of environment with Tom. All right, number three, reason number three is going to work, the weapons around him. This one's pretty obvious. We don't need to belabor this point. Mike Evans, Chris Godwin, O.J. Howard, Cam Brate. Cam Brate readjusted his contract of late because he wants to play with Tom Brady. Good skill position talent there. I think Ronald Jones has still some potential. Former second-round pick came around a little bit last year. They could still add a back. Like Le'Veon Bell is somebody that sort of sticks out to me as maybe a guy that would be an interesting addition for them. So that's reason number three, good weapons around him. Number four, the division. Carolina's rebuilding. We don't know what we're going to get from Atlanta. To me, like it's really New Orleans is the hurdle for them. And New Orleans has got a great roster around Drew Brees. Is Drew Brees going to be the same player he has been? That's, I think, sort of an open question. So to me, it's, you know, really kind of mano-a-mano in that division, whereas if he'd gone to, say, the Chargers, you'd be dealing with the Chiefs behemoth. The Raiders are getting a lot better. It's just a different dynamic in the NFC South, where I think it really is right now the Bucs and the Saints. And then finally, number five, I really feel almost like all you need to do with Brady is get in the playoffs. And this was proven a couple of years ago. In 2018, the Patriots sort of stumbled around in November and December. They didn't look like themselves. And when it counted most, Brady stepped up and made plays, even when the offense wasn't great. He won a shootout against Patrick Mahomes in the AFC title game, and then 2 weeks later came back in the Super Bowl, and in a game that was incredibly well game-planned by Wade Phillips, he did the job when it mattered most at the very end of the game, and sometimes that's all you need. And so do I think Brady can be the quarterback he was, say, 5 years ago, on a 16-week basis? No. But if he can get back to the point, if he can get the team to January, which I think he's still capable of doing, he can be an enormous difference maker when you get to January, because he's not affected by the environment. He's not affected by the stakes. We know what he can do on the biggest stage. So those are the five reasons that I think, you know, you really, there are five reasons for real optimism with a 43-year-old quarterback if you're the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Brady's investment in them, their investment in him, the weapons around him, the division, and what could happen when you get to the playoffs and how kind of small that is. When you get to the playoffs, it's about winning three games. Takeaway number two, the Patriots reboot is on, and I've been asked by a lot of people what they're doing at the quarterback position. Here's what I would tell you. I don't think we're going to see a big swing here. Now, if Cam Newton or Andy Dalton or someone like that wants to come in at a discount, that's one thing. But you know, as far as financial investment, I think they're sort of where they want to be right now. They brought Brian Hoyer in at a cut rate. They've got Jared Stidham there for less than $1 million. They've got Cody Kessler there for less than $1 million. It wouldn't surprise me in the least if they drafted another player at the position. I think this is sort of where they're at. They're trying to financially reset, and I think that goes for everything across the roster. You know, they've gotten older. They've gotten expensive in certain areas because they've struck out on draft picks. You know, they have just, they need to go through sort of an economic cleansing. And I think this is the year that they take the bullet on that. They're going to be carrying Brady's $13.5 million in dead money. I believe they got somewhere near $25 million in dead money. It's hard to say they're ever in a rebuild. When Bill Belichick's the coach, I don't know that you'll ever see a team that's not going to be very, very competitive. But like you look at where they are financially and some of the situations that they've created for themselves logistically, and it just looks like this is the year that they're going to rip the Band-Aid off, take the bullet for all the financial issues they have, and then go into 2021 with a clean economic situation at quarterback and with a clean economic situation on their roster. I'd also say this. There's a very logical way to look at Jared Stidham and at least think that there could be something there. Here's what I mean. In 2018, the Patriots drafted a guy in the seventh round named Danny Etling. Now, when they drafted him, they felt like there was some physical ability there, and it just was underdeveloped because he hadn't been coached all that well at Purdue or at LSU. And they thought, okay, if we can get a guy who's got some physical ability into our system, work with him, maybe we can capitalize on what we believe is a distressed asset. Didn't work out. Danny Etling wound up cut. I think he's on someone's practice squad somewhere now. At one point, he wasn't even playing quarterback anymore. That one didn't work out. But the same idea applied in 2019 when they drafted Jared Stidham. And here's how you kind of follow the bouncing ball with Jared Stidham. All right, blue chip recruit out of high school, started right away for Art Briles at Baylor as a true freshman. He winds up, you know, as kind of, you know, a spectator to what was an awful situation there, right? So everything comes undone. Art Briles gets fired. Jared Stidham transfers. Well, then he transfers after starting as a freshman at Baylor, transfers to Auburn. Sits a year per the transfer rules. Plays in 2017 and plays really well, right, in a system that didn't fit great for him, and then regresses a little bit in 2018. But a lot of that had to do, again, with the scheme that he was playing in, which was a scheme that was built for Cam Newton almost a decade ago. That scheme's not a bad scheme. It just didn't work for him. And so what the Patriots saw in Jared Stidham was a distressed asset, a guy who is a talented kid, smart kid, good leader, got like some statesmen about him, but just – was in the wrong situation a couple times, and it wound up killing his stock. And so what they looked at in 2019 was this kid could be could have wound up being a first-round pick, but it didn't play out that way because of the circumstances around him. So maybe if we can get him in our system, maybe then, you know, we'll wind up in a situation where now all of a sudden we're able to harvest that first-round ability. So not saying it's going to happen, just saying that's part of the logic there. Takeaway number three, Cam Newton. If he hasn't been cut by the time you're listening to this, he will be cut soon. The Panthers were going to make one last-ditch attempt on Tuesday to try and get something for him. Chances are they're not going to be able to. His number at $19.1 million in cash for 2020 is too high, with teams lacking the ability to bring him in and give him a physical. Take a look at that left foot. Take a look at that right shoulder. And so, in all likelihood, the first pick in the 2011 draft, the 2015 NFL MVP, the quarterback that won the NFC Championship during that MVP year is likely to be a street free agent fairly soon. So why does this happen? How does this happen? How does a guy of Cam Newton's ability wind up in this spot? There are a couple factors. One, the aforementioned health issue is real, and the fact that teams can't bring him in and have their team doctor get hands on him, that's a factor. And it's hard to get around that. If you plan on making a guy your starting quarterback or plan on making a $20 million investment in a guy and he's got injury history like Cam does, it's very hard to trade for a guy without getting a full picture of what's going on there. And so that part of it really made it so the Panthers weren't going to be able to get value, maybe get any value, and by the looks of it, get any value for Cam Newton. And it's crazy to think that they wind up trading Kyle Allen, right? They wind up trading Kyle Allen and get a fifth round pick for him, but they can't move Cam Newton for even that much. So that's sort of why he is where he is. Now, why wasn't there more interest from other teams just in taking a flyer on him, maybe? I think that this part of it's interesting too. And I think it sort of relates to Jay Cutler and how Jay Cutler's value as a player tanked after he was no longer a starting quarterback. And you may remember, like, he winds up deciding, I'm retiring from football after the Bears were going to get rid of him. He was going to go into TV. Then all of a sudden he pops back up in the radar that summer when Ryan Tannehill gets hurt. Adam Gase's background with him brings him in as a starter. So I don't think Jay Cutler was in a position where he could have gone and been a backup quarterback a lot of places. And the reason why, he'd always been a starter. There have been questions about kind of, you know, how he carried himself, his place in the organization, and how he'd handle not being a starting quarterback. With Cam Newton, I think there's the same sort of thing. There are strings attached with him. He was a super blue chip recruit coming out of high school, went to the University of Florida, sat for a year, wound up in junior college, was a star there, got to Auburn, was at Auburn for 1 year, wins the Heisman Trophy, goes to the pros, number one overall pick, starts week one, has never not been a starting quarterback outside of that 1 year at Florida. So how's he going to handle that? You know, I think there's that part of it. If you're not automatically going to hand him the starting job, is that going to be a problem for you? Can you bring him in, say, like the Titans brought in Ryan Tannehill last year and say, okay, you're our backup, and if something goes wrong with the starter, then you're here for us? Would Cam be okay with that? Would you be comfortable that Cam would be able to operate in a team-first way if you did that? Like, that's sort of the question, is like no one's ever really seen him in that position before because he's a superstar talent. He's got superstar ability. He's always carried himself like a superstar. And so that's a question he's going to have to answer for teams. If he goes to the Chargers, let's just, they're the ones that's sort of sitting out there. If he goes to the Chargers, would the Chargers look at him and say, okay, we're going to throw you into a competition with Tyrod Taylor? It sounds absurd, right? But they've made, you know, they really like Tyrod. They like the idea of having Tyrod as their bridge quarterback. So based on your foot cam, based on your shoulder cam, we like you. We want to take a chance on you, but are you going to be okay being in that environment where you have to compete for the job, where you have to win the job? That might be tough for him. And so I think that's sort of where it's at with Cam right now. I don't know whether or not it's going to change much when he becomes a free agent and he sees that the money might not be there either. Will he want to go somewhere on the sort of deal that, like, say, Marcus Mariota just signed with the Raiders, which is really $7.5 million, and you can earn the rest based on the way you play, based on how much you play, based on team success, if you're playing, all that stuff. I don't know. You know, I think that's an unanswered question because Cam Newton's never been in that sort of situation before. Takeaway number four, Trent Williams. Trent Williams had a very interesting Tuesday morning. We saw what happened with the Redskins. His agent announced as well, we've exhausted all of our trade scenarios. We're looking at this now and saying to ourselves, why can't you just let Trent Williams go? Well, here's the problem. Trent Williams does have trade value. In fact, if Trent Williams was willing to report on his existing contract, the Redskins would be able to get value for him. The problem is his contract demands have been such where he wants to be the highest paid tackle in football. At one point over the last year, he actually asked the Redskins for quarterback money, and other teams know this. And so if you're another team, if you look at where his contract is right now and it's affordable, what's left of it, you'd say, okay, yeah, we do that to bring in a starting left tackle of Trent Williams caliber. No question about it. Absolutely, we'd do that. But if you're asking for premium draft capital plus a contract, now we're talking about something else. Now we're talking about using the cap space you have as an asset and using the draft picks you have as an asset, combining them and putting them together and going and getting that player. That's, again, like, it's happened. It happened with Frank Clark. It happened with Dee Ford. But it's hard when you're asking for both. And that's sort of where the Texans were with DeAndre Hopkins, where DeAndre Hopkins didn't want a contract extension. DeAndre Hopkins wanted his contract ripped up, and he wanted a new contract. He has 3 years left on his deal. And, you know, going back a year, that's what happened with Antonio Brown, where he did have some trade value. And because, you know, he wanted what Hopkins is asking for, a bunch of teams backed off, and the Raiders were able to get him for a 3 and a 5. And so if you're the Redskins, you're sitting here and saying, well, we're willing to accommodate you. We're willing to trade you out of town. You know, but we want a certain return for a player who has been one of the best left tackles in football, a guy who we drafted fourth overall in 2010, and then we extended. And, like, if we can't get fair value for you, sorry. Like, that's not on us. That's because you're asking for a big contract. And so I think that's sort of where it's at right now. It's been an ugly situation from the start. I think Ron Rivera has done what he can to try to make this thing better, and I think it is better than it was when Bruce Allen and, you know, Jay Gruden, Bill Callahan, those guys were there. I think it's better than it was. But if Trent Williams isn't willing to play ball here, if he insists on the contract, well, that's going to cause the Redskins to not get the return that they want. And if you're the Redskins, you look at that and say, well, we don't really have great motivation to move you if we can't get value back. Finally, takeaway number five, we'll get to our guest. The Rams' new logo, on the lighter side here, the Rams' new logo has been released. I am not a fan of the LA logo. I know it's been kind of panned across the internet. It looks too USFL-ish to me. It kind of looks like, you know, the logo you'd see for a fictional team in a movie that doesn't have rights to the NFL. But I really like the ram head. And I think as long as they, and I like the colors too. So I think if they went with the ram head as their primary logo, and then they kept the royal blue and the yellow, which they have, I think that was a great call to do that. If the uniforms look like the classic, like 80s, 90s, like yellow and blue uniforms, maybe updated fonts or whatever, then I'm good with that. And I'm good with it if you go with the ram head logo. But I do not like the LA logo. And we will continue to, because we're going to have plenty of time to do this, we'll continue to give you our uniform logo reviews. We still have the Browns, the Falcons, the Bucks. All those teams are getting new logos. I know the Patriots are going to have new uniforms to some degree. Some things are going to change. And I believe I saw the Chargers too, which it's unconfirmed as far as I know. But Rams logo, the primary logo, thumbs down. The secondary logo, thumbs up. You should make that the primary logo. We haven't seen the uniforms yet, but the uniform should go back and look a lot like the 80s, 90s Rams uniforms, which they've been wearing as alternates anyway. And we will get to our special guest right after this. All right, so we're going to bring in a guy who's become a good friend of mine. We do pre and post on NBC Sports Boston every week, before and after Patriots games. He played for the Patriots for 9 years, I think. I think it's 9 years. And he's also worked in the Houston market. We're bringing in former NFL linebacker Ted Johnson. Ted, what's up?
Hey, Burr. What's going on, buddy? Good to be with you.
All right, so, like, first of all, this is long overdue. I've been meaning to have Ted on for a while. He does a great job. And I want to start here. Having played with Brady his first 5 years, and having known the guy since he was, I guess, the 23-year-old with the ugly yellow Jeep. When you saw that pop up on social media last week and you see the finality of it, what sort of running through your head? Were you surprised? Did it catch you off guard? Did you reflect? How does something like that hit you?
Yeah, it was no surprise to me, Bert. I mean, I felt like a lot of people were given the chances of coming back to New England to get a 50-50 deal. There was enough evidence, and then really the last couple of years that suggested he was gone. He was at his wit's end, that this was not kind of at this point in his career that he wanted to acquiesce, take a below market kind of value deal, that he really looked like he was ready to move on. And there was just a lot of different things. You can go back to, I think one of the big kind of clues was not attending OTAs after the 2017 season, not attending the OTAs after the 2018 season. Just his overall attitude this year, Bert, just really miserable. When the team was on a roll there to start the season. And then just some of the things that he was saying, I think particularly, Bert, one of the more revealing comments I heard Tom make was in regards to his contract this past training camp. When they asked him about his contract, he's like, I don't know, guys, go ask Mr. Kraft, you know? And it was like, it was such a throwaway kind of, a line that maybe you would not think it was that revealing, but it really was. It was very, very telling, because you have to understand, I think Tom and Mr. Kraft have had an alliance. They have been aligned philosophically for a very, very long time. And that was the first time I think you saw maybe that relationship was not what it used to be. That it truly, all the reports were that Robert Kraft was disengaging from contract negotiations and he was going to let Tom and Bill handle that. And I think that was maybe probably one of the deepest cuts of all for Tom, because he's always had Mr. Kraft in his corner when it came to contracts. And so I think, and I played for Bill for 6 years. He's a very difficult man to work for and to play for. And I think just all this stuff that was kind of going on, that we don't probably have time to mention all the things, it just finally caught up to Tom. And he was like, he wasn't afraid to take a chance and step out of his comfort zone finally for the first time in his career, try something new. And so I'm fascinated to see how it all works out, man.
I want to get to like the program and like how tough it is to play in that program in a minute. But you did hit on something there with the contract, right? And he's been playing for, and I'm sure like as a player, there were probably points in your career where you felt like you were underpaid, right? I think every player probably has that. How much, like, because Brady's been on, I think, what most people would consider below market deals for most of his career. How does that wear on a player? Like, because I think we've all probably, like, in all of our lines of work, there's probably points where we feel that too, you know? It's just a, like, normal, like, human, you know, human way of thinking. Like, how does that wear on a player when you're going out there and you're sacrificing yourself and doing what you need to do to get through an NFL season and all of that, and you don't feel like your pay is commensurate with what you're putting out there?
It does. It catches up to you. It's here's the thing. I think guys can maybe it can be more palatable to take a below market deal for a couple reasons at least. One, you got to be winning, right? I think there's got to be this. Hey, that's the trade off. I'm going to maybe take less money, and then a big payoff is going to be winning. But also, Bert, I think it's just overall how you feel like you are treated by the organization. Not just the owner, because the owner, we all know, loves Brady. But Brady doesn't, you know, have FaceTime every single day with the owner like he does Bill Belichick. And I think Tom was probably like, this is the one guy. It's that dad, Bert, that some people have that is so reluctant to give his praise and so makes you work so hard to get any kind of affirmation from him. That is Bill Belichick. And I think Tom just wanted some acknowledgement, some day-to-day kind of respect handed to him. A lot of people say, yeah, well, that's your pro. That shouldn't have to come with it. I think Tom feels like he's accomplished so much that he should be the exception to the rule. And there's a lot of people who say, well, Bill treats everybody the same. That's not necessarily true. I mean, I think players that he has that he likes, that he kind of considers his guys that patrol the locker room. And Tom maybe wasn't one of those guys. He was very hard on Tom in meetings, very reluctant to acknowledge Tom for doing good jobs in certain games. He didn't get the game ball. I know that sounds crazy to people, but that wears on you. If you're going to be giving up financial, financially speaking, giving money back to the team, then you at least want the day-to-day kind of treatment of you from the head coach and the coaches to be respectful and, you know, affirmative. And I don't think Tom was getting that. So I think it just finally catches up to where it's like, you know what, it's not worth it anymore.
Do you think Bill was that way to Tom to prove a point? Because I've always heard, like, it enables the whole program, right? Like, it enables the program that if you're sitting in the room and you're watching Tom Brady, the greatest of all time, getting chewed out, you know, no one's safe, right? Like, so how much of it do you think the way that he handled Tom over the last 20 years, and really, I mean, I guess more so like the last, 15, 16, 17 years, because that's really when he's sort of gotten to that point where he's a superstar. Like, how much of that do you think was to prove a point?
Huge. I think it's huge because it establishes the culture. If the most important player on the team is willing to sacrifice from a financial standpoint for the greater good, then it's so easy for everyone to fall in line. And I compare the Patriots a lot to kind of another franchise that I think has had just, you know, a lot of success with a coach that I think is on par with the Bills' ability, but in a different sport. And that is the San Antonio Spurs with Popovich. I always kind of felt like what makes that San Antonio kind of engine go for so long is that Pop could be very hard on Tim Duncan, on Tony Parker, on Manu Ginobili. And that made everyone else fall in line, okay? So I think that's it's a great point you're making, that Bill, the culture was partly established by how Bill could treat Tom and that Tom's acceptance with that treatment. I mean, Tom accepted these below market value deals for a very long. He bought into that culture. I mean, he was one of the flag carriers for that, for Bill Belichick, as far as you got to sacrifice if you're going to be here, but you'll win. I think that for most of his career, he was that way. And I think Tom probably felt like, you know, at the end, well, I should probably be treated a little different, Bill, right? I should maybe get a little bit more leeway. And it doesn't look like Belichick was willing to do that from a contractual standpoint, and maybe just on a day-to-day standpoint on how you communicate, talk, and relate to that player. And Tom was like, man, Phil probably felt like I've earned the right to be treated differently then you've treated me all these years and you're not doing it. So I'm going to go try something different now.
Well, you mentioned that, like, and we can get to the like sort of existing in that program thing now, because what you just hit on, like, how you always hear how hard it is to be there, like on a day-to-day basis, and how it wears you down mentally and how it can wear you down physically even. Like, what does that mean? Like I know it's like seems like a simple question, but like, what is hard about working there day to day versus maybe, and you know, you were under Pete Carroll for 3 years too, so you saw a different way. What is so hard about being in that environment on a day to day basis?
Yeah, and well, Bill creates a work environment that's so unique and different. I've had, luckily in my 10 years, Bert, I have a pretty cool kind of perspective. So I had three coaches in my 10 years, Bill Parcells, Pete Carroll, and Bill Belichick. All three are going to be Hall of Fame. One's already in the Hall of Fame. I think Pete's going to be in the Hall of Fame. We know Bill's going to, Belichick's going to be Hall of Fame. We're all three Hall of Fame coaches. All taught and leadership styles are so very different. You know, Parcells was tough, but you know what? It was a kind of a fun working environment. He got the best out of his players. He could be hard on you, but he could always, like he likes to say, throw you a fish, come back, build you back up again. Pete was fun all the time. Didn't necessarily work here, but it was a very kind of relaxed working environment. And I don't think that's the best environment when you're trying to put together a top-flight football team. I think the culture demands a little bit more discipline. And then you got Bill, who's the complete polar opposite of both of those guys. He coached through fear and kind of in a way that, look, if you do what I say, the team's going to be better off. So you were just kind of, you felt like you were a chess piece in his game. Very much emotion is taken out of it. You don't feel as a player, certain players maybe do with him than others, that he has a real emotional investment in seeing you do well. And I think football players are all wired with emotion, you know, and you kind of want to think that the coach that's coaching you kind of cares a little bit about you, the person, and, you know, do you have kids? Do you have parents? Do you, you know, what are you like as a person? That's just things he's not really doesn't care about. And so it becomes, you draw closer to the guys. We're all kind of miserable together. So, it's a very much a place where you are singing for your supper every single day. You're worried about losing your job. All of a sudden your reps aren't what they used to be. And I love how, and I think Michael Bennett said it at the beginning of this past training camp. And I just kind of had a chuckle to myself because I'm like, oh, he doesn't know Bill Belichick that well. He's like, well, he treats you like a man. You always know where you stand with Bill Belichick. No, you don't. You never know where you stand with Bill. So you never know what he's thinking in regards to you. You know, when he demotes you, he doesn't come tell you why. He doesn't tell you what you think he thinks you need to do better. You're in the complete dark about it. And so you're left to trying to figure it out yourself. And that makes for a very nerve-wracking kind of day-to-day work environment that I think is unique to the rest of the teams in the NFL, because he's just emotionless and doesn't care about your feelings, and you should just accept everything without any having any real issues about it, which unfortunately there's a human element to play in this game. You know that. And so I think it's very difficult for most guys to kind of buy in. If you're not winning, for sure, buy-in's going to be tougher.
So, yeah, like that's actually what I was just going to ask is, like, this has got to be almost like completely results oriented then, right? Because if the whole thing is, I'm giving you the answers to the test, listen to me and you'll have the answers to the test, we'll win and you'll wind up benefiting individually from it, then yeah, like that could work. And it did work for Tom. I'm guessing for Tom, it's like, look what happened with him. Like, so as much as he didn't like it, maybe there was that part, but it requires the results, right? So maybe last year he doesn't get the same individual results, and they don't get quite, and it doesn't mean they were bad, but like the individual results kind of aren't what they were before. The team result isn't what it was the year before. And maybe it becomes a little bit harder to swallow all of that. Right.
I think it's just way harder to swallow it. And here's the thing. It's not, Bill's not always right. Okay. I mean, he is right most of the time, but there is one thing that you can point to where you can say Bill Belichick was wrong, just flat out wrong. And it was in one of the most kind of public world stage complete and utter like screw ups by Bill Belichick, where, you know, I can tend to maybe be very critical of Bill because I know the man, I know the nature of the man. And when it comes to his X's and O's, far superior. Nobody can touch Bill Belichick. Got it. But when it comes to the human being, I will say he can be petty. He can be vindictive. He can hold grudges. And I just think that Malcolm Butler benching in the Super Bowl, it really shook a lot of guys in that locker room. And I think cost them, ultimately, a chance to win their sixth Super Bowl at that time. Now they've won their sixth in 2018. But in that season, I think that really rubbed guys the wrong way. And so that's just one kind of incident where it's like, and they were sleepwalking through the first part of that 2018 season until they kind of figured it out at the end. But there's one thing. It's like, you know what, Bill? You know, you kind of let your personal stuff in the way of doing what was right for the team when he's always saying it's what's best for the team. So that's kind of one thing you can look at where I think players are probably like, man, it's not worth it, man. When we get to this point and you pull that kind of deal out, and we end up losing the whole thing, where it's like, it's tough for guys to swallow that. If you're going to take below market value deals, you're not going to be praised that much. You're not going to be, you know, feel like your value going to work. You better win a lot, Bert, and you better not put us in a position to win and then let your personal stuff intervene and pettiness intervene and lose us a big game.
So speaking of pettiness and personal stuff, like, how much do you think these two guys are motivated by proving, and you know both of them, how much do you think they're motivated by proving it was me? You know what I mean? The six championships, the 20 years of unprecedented success, that was me. That wasn't him. That was me. Like, how much do you think Tom's motivated by that? How much do you think Bill's motivated by that?
Well, I think they're both motivated by it, but I think in particular, Bill Belichick is so ready to prove that he can win without Tom Brady. And that's what makes guys like in our business, I think that's what makes this whole thing so fascinating. I really think Bill wants to show that he can win without Tom. Let's face it. Bill Belichick's career did not really take off until when? Week four of the 2001 season when Tom Brady started for Drew Bledsoe. And then it just, you know, it's been an unprecedented amount of success in a 20-year window. But it didn't start until Tom Brady was his quarterback. Yeah, but Ted, he's got games where he's won without Tom. Yeah, he has. But back years after year after year, a winning culture hasn't been established without Tom Brady being your quarterback. And so I think he is so driven by that piece right there. And I think he was really ready to move on from Tom. You can say, hey, we made him an offer, but you truly didn't make an offer that I think was an honest offer that you knew Tom would maybe be open to. So to me, he got his desired effect, and that was for Tom Brady to move on. So now he can start coaching without Tom, and I think prove to everybody that he doesn't need Tom Brady as his quarterback to win football games. Bill, he thinks, Bert, and he is. I mean, he is the smartest coach I've ever been around. But he's got a big ego, and he is driven by that ego, and he's got a ton of pride. And so this is – he's getting what he wants, and I can't wait to see how it all turns out for him.
Yeah, like, so – like, and I know you like, it's hard to separate one from the other, but I always think of, like, when they rebuilt in 09 and sort of, like, the changeover from the guys you played with, like the Vrabels, the Harrisons, the Laws, you know, the Troy Browns, that group – to what became like almost Patriots 2.0, Gronkowski, McCourty, like Aaron Hernandez for the short time, like that changeover, like they never really had to go through a rebuild because Tom could still elevate everybody around him, right? Like he could still like, hey, I'll make it work while we're rebuilding this thing. That's really hard to do, right? Like that's really, really hard to do. Yep. So like, this is gonna be a tough question. How much of it do you think like if you had to split it up, how much of it do you think of the last 20 years is Bill and how much of it is Brady? Is it even? Is there one more responsible than the other? Like, how do you look at that?
You know, I have always kind of leaned this question more towards Bill. Like, a lot of people think I'm crazy. How is Bill Belichick more important than Tom Brady? I just think it's so difficult to get buy-in. from the players if you're the head coach. It's so hard to motivate year after year after year a lot of the same core group of guys and get them to buy in. It's just hard to establish a culture of a winning culture like Bill has created. But I say, I've always said it's Bill, but I'm starting to kind of maybe lean towards Tom because a big part of it, and we've already touched on it, is the way Bill was able to create this culture, this winning culture that's very demanding and no one's getting overpaid and everybody's, to the most degree, treated the same. It all was because Tom allowed himself to be the kind of poster child for that culture. And I mean, and I've been in team meetings where Bill is very critical of Tom. You know, he is on a lot of guys, but it allowed him to, so he could do that to establish this culture, like we mentioned before, that if Tom Brady's not above getting chewed out, then we all got to be ready to be chewed out if we're not doing our job. So I'm going to almost lean more towards Tom. So, and when it comes to answering that question, because that he was almost the poster child for that culture. And if Bill didn't have Tom to kind of, you know, point to as the guy, like if he can take it, we all can, then I'm not so sure that culture is ingrained and established as much as it was. So it's the next year or two, I can't wait to see the buy-in from these players without Tom being there, you know, kind of as the guy to point to.
Okay, so last thing on this then. I'm going to give you a story. I was with Drew Bledsoe probably – this is probably – and I know you're Drew, good friend of yours. This is probably 4 years ago now, 3.5 years ago. It was on the anniversary of the hit. And, you know, I remember Drew saying to me, like, that he thought, like, his relationship was dead with Belichick. And that – like he was nervous to go back to Foxborough, and this guy is like very close to the owner, an icon in the area, all of that. He was afraid to go back to Foxborough because he didn't know how Bill would react, and he didn't go back there after he retired. And in 11, he gets elected to the Team Hall of Fame, and so they bring him back to introduce him. And he said he was like almost nervous walking out on the practice field because he knew he'd run into Bill, and he saw Bill. And I think I may have told you this story before, but he saw Bill, and he said Bill couldn't have been warmer. And he said Bill came up to him, asked about his wife, asked about his kids, asked about his wine. And Drew said, I was shocked. It was like a totally different guy. And I wonder about that, Ted, because I'm trying to project this forward and look at where the Brady-Belichick relationship will be 10 years from now. But Bill's always struck me as somebody who is just hyper-disciplined about separating his professional life from his personal life. And once you're gone, you switch. Once you're gone as a player, you go from being a part of his professional life where he has to treat you one way to being a part of his personal life where he's a totally different guy. Do you buy that that happens with Brady?
Oh, man, Bert, that's a great story to highlight, I think, what is a clear pattern by Bill Belichick. And that is, hey, man, sorry they don't like me as player. I'm going to do what, you know, what I think is right or how I want to do things. I'll make up with them later. And there's so many examples of that. I don't care who it is. Richard Seymour, Mike Vrabel, Malcolm Butler. You know, they had a call in the offseason after the benching. They're buddies now. Bill's smart to do that because he doesn't want, you know, there's a lot of secrets. And a lot of players, former players, know a lot about Bill, how he treated them, things that went on behind closed doors. And while Bill is still a relevant head coach in this league, nobody's going to say a word. But Bill's smart to kind of, I think, reconcile with those guys, extend an olive branch to those guys, like you said he did with Drew. And I think more than anything, guys want to be invited behind the velvet rope. They want to be part of, you know, what's going on. And so they accept that kind of response from Bill. They want that, you know, and so all the stuff that went on in the past can all be forgotten. Bill does a very good job, as much as is a difficult kind of, you know, taskmaster he has to play for. Later in life, he knows it's probably in his best interest to kind of make amends with these former players because, you know, he acts like he doesn't maybe care about the media, but he does. He cares about what people are saying about him and how he's being portrayed. And he's almost borderline obsessive with it. And so he's smart to mend fences with those players that he didn't have maybe good relationships with. So my point is to that, oh, him and Brady, like that. In 10 years, oh, yeah. I mean, it needs a little bit of time to kind of work its way out. And then I guarantee you, he's so skilled at making that connection again with guys that I guarantee he'll do it with Brady, and Brady will he'll buy into it.
Absolutely. Okay. So before I let you go, because you were down in Houston, you were around Billy O'Brien, you did have a chance to watch DeAndre Hopkins up close for a bunch of years. Your reaction to what's going on down there and how things have changed over the last year. Obviously Jack Easterby now is the executive vice president there. They've traded Jadeveon Clowney. They've traded DeAndre Hopkins. They traded for Laremy Tunsil. The face of the team, I mean, and this is rare with a guy who is, I think, going into year seven now as a head coach, where it almost feels like they're changing the culture again, I just wonder, just as somebody who saw everything down there, your reaction to what's happened, in general, and then in particular, the DeAndre Hopkins trade.
I was shocked by that trade. I did not know that maybe potentially there was, an issue there between DeAndre and the head coach. What I knew of DeAndre Hopkins, I covered that team for about 7 years, Bert, was, I mean, he kept his mouth shut and he worked his ass off and he went out and he produced. That's all I've ever known of DeAndre Hopkins. Now, I've been away for the last couple of years. When things change, you have the success that he's had, then maybe he's not the same guy to deal with anymore. So when I kind of heard that news, I thought, oh boy, I thought one thing. The first thought in my mind when I saw him get traded to the Arizona Cardinals for a second rounder was he might be the Bills losing the team. That he could potentially be losing the team. When you trade away your best asset, not named Deshaun Watson, it can really rock you. And so if you don't have DeAndre Hopkins on your side, or you don't have Jadeveon Clowney on your side, and maybe, on the same page, with you as far as the direction of the team's going, then it's going to be harder for the other guys. Now, there's an iconic name still on that team, J.J. Watt, but he's been injured the last few years, Bert, and so maybe his kind of support of Billy O doesn't carry the same weight as maybe those other players. But that's the first thing I thought of, is that, oh, there's not buy-in from his players. If he's getting rid of that kind of caliber of player, it tells me that those two weren't getting along, and that my feeling is he influences all the rest of the roster, DeAndre Hopkins does. And so what he maybe said on the way out, or what he's maybe been saying about Bill O'Brien, filters to the rest of the team. And so I just worry about his ability to get guys to play hard for him, to buy in, and want to back him as the head coach. I'm worried that might be, I don't know, who knows, maybe coming to an end. I hope not.
Well, so, all right, last thing then, because I think that this part's interesting. So, let's say they did that for culture, which is what my belief is, that they did this, it's a culture thing, right? And then you see what's happened in Detroit, where they're bringing in Jamie Collins, Daron Harmon, and Danny Shelton. In Miami with Brian Flores, they're bringing in Kyle Van Noy, Ted Karras, and Alandon Roberts. Even with the Giants now, Joe Judge going there, they're bringing in Nate Ebner and Deion Lewis. You were there when Bill first got to New England, and he brought in, I believe, Brian Cox, Anthony Pleasant, Roman Pfeiffer, a few guys that had played for him with the Jets. Do you think the culture thing's overdone at all, or trying to replicate what you had in Foxborough is too difficult to do in this day and age?
Ooh, I think you can bring in culture guys, that you can bring in former Patriots. I get it, and maybe hope some of that rubs off, but it still comes down to the head coach. I mean, you can have guys that are played for Bill go to other teams, and they can maybe have, I think, a minor impact. But if the head coach isn't built the same way, wired the same way like Bill Belichick, I don't think a few players from a Bill Belichick team is going to make all that big of a difference. I really, really don't. It's the head coach. It's how you're dressed every day. It's after a win, Does he seem like, you know, does he make it like it's just another win and you got to forget it and move on, like Bill does? Or you know, are you a head coach that, you know, is different? So I think it comes down to more about the head coach, because you've seen so many former assistant coaches for Bill Belichick go on to be head coaches, try to be the hard-o like Bill is. And one thing you can't do in this league, Bert, is be somebody you're not. If you're a head coach that is acting like disingenuous or inauthentic or not maybe true to yourself, players sniff that out and they won't have much respect for you at all.
It's funny, the one guy that seems to have worked from best that came out of that program as a head coach is a guy who wasn't a coach for him, was a player for him, Mike Vrabel. Like he seems like he has the potential to be the best of them.
Yeah, you know what? But Mike is very, I think, authentic and real and true to himself. And so I see him coaching like he played. Now, my guess is he's probably taken a lot of things he learned from Bill and applying it, but just not from the personality standpoint, more from the X's and O's standpoint, which would be smart of Mike to do.
Okay, that's Ted Johnson, former Patriots linebacker. He's with me all the time on NBC Sports Boston, former commentator down in Houston. Ted, always appreciate you coming out. We'll definitely have you on again. We waited too long to make this happen.
Anytime, Bert, man. I always enjoy chopping it up with you, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks to Ted. Always great catching up with him. We have a great time in the fall in the postgame and the pregame show, and he's just a great dude in general. Happy to have him on the show here for the very first time. And from there, we're going to jump right into your questions. Because of the circumstances, as you guys have noticed the last couple of weeks, we've reverted to doing the questions that you guys send us the way we used to do them. So went from being voicemails and emails now back to doing the six-pack. Longtime listeners of the show understand how the six-pack works. We put the call out for questions on Twitter. We ask, you respond. If your question gets picked, we give you a like on Twitter. That means I hit that little heart button there and you get an answer here. Question number one for the week from Smith. That's at Brian_1953. Brian's asking, how interested will the Colts be in Jalen Hurts? Brian, I do think that there will be, I think the Colts are going to do their homework on the quarterbacks this year, but I think part of trading the 13th overall pick for DeForest Buckner was an acknowledgement that maybe they didn't think that their long-term answer was there. And furthermore, I think that the addition of Philip Rivers is a sign that they are planning, that they are doing their best to sort of keep the train on the tracks with the program as they've built it the last 3 years. And, you know, just sort of treading water for the next year or two at the position until they can find the next answer. That in fact is exactly why, you know, and we reported this a month ago, why Brady was sort of a non-starter for them and why they didn't pursue Tom Brady. Because, you know, when they looked at it, they said, okay, if we bring in Tom Brady, now we're going to be all in for 1 or 2 years. We're going to probably disrupt our program in several different ways. And that's not saying that in a negative way. It's just the fact of the way that would have gone. And they didn't want to do that. You know, they've drafted really well the last few years. They've got a lot of good young players in their team. Guys, you know, like Darius Leonard, like Quentin Nelson, like Rocky Sin. And so they want to sort of kind of keep the building process going as it's been going. And the best thing for them to do to keep that going was to bring in a guy they knew that wouldn't disrupt much as far as how they've been building their program. Philip Rivers knows Nick Sirianni. He knows Frank Reich. So it made all the sense in the world to go forward with two quarterbacks in Rivers and Jacoby Brissett that you know, that you like, that'll buy you a year. And if they're willing to come back in 2021, maybe 2 years, to find the long-term answer. I would expect the Colts will be headlong into the 2021 quarterback class, and it should be a good one. Clemson's Trevor Lawrence, Ohio State's Justin Fields at the top of that group. Question number two is from Rick. That's at RickConk13. I know the draft is loaded with receivers, but the free agency market for them has been non-existent. What are the reasons? Well, I think, Rick, you just sort of hit on it inadvertently there. Because the draft is loaded at receiver, teams aren't being as aggressive with the free agent market because they know we get to April, not even necessarily in the first round, in the second or third round, we may be able to find starting level players. And then they look back and they see the last few years when the receiver group in the draft wasn't as strong as this year. They're like, wow, you can find answers in the second round. There's Michael Thomas. There's DJ Chark. There are the two Ole Miss kids last year, AJ Brown and DK Metcalf. So, you know, I think what's hurt receivers on the free agent market, guys like Robbie Anderson, is that the draft class is so strong that teams are saying, why spend in March? Why overspend in March when there are going to be answers for us there in April? Question number three from Mo Butts. That's O at Mo Sound Guy. Most likely dark horse team to trade up for a quarterback. Why don't I give you the Tampa Bay Buccaneers as one? And I know that sounds weird, but they don't have a ton of pressing needs in their team. And maybe it makes sense for them to put the guy who will succeed Tom Brady on the roster. Now, you may remember, and I'm going to bring up this comparison again, but Denver, Peyton Manning, 2012, what did they do? They drafted Brock Osweiler that year. Now, obviously, it worked out in 2015 where they won the Super Bowl in part because he was able to kind of keep the train rolling when he got in there. But he didn't wind up being the long-term answer. But the point is they felt like they had to put a younger piece at the position because they had gotten so much older with their starter. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see Tampa at some point take a quarterback because they look at it and they say, okay, this is where we need to make our move. And we need to put somebody on the roster who could be the long-term answer. The other team I would keep an eye on is just the Raiders, just because they've got two first-round picks. They're picking 12th and 19th. That 19th pick, of course, is one of the last pieces of the Khalil Mack trade. And I do know that they've sort of continued to look for ways to upgrade. Marcus Mariota will sort of be playing the role that Ryan Tannehill played behind him in Tennessee next year, where it's like, you know, in case of emergency, break glass guy. They've tried to create competition for Derek Carr. Let's just say they get really clean medicals back from Tua Tagovailoa's people. Let's say, and I don't know how he's going to prove it, but he does something like where they're, wow, you know, we got to look at this. And let's say because of the medicals, maybe other people assess it differently, he starts to slip in the top 10. Is it crazy to think Vegas could make a little move up to go and get Tagovailoa? Not in my mind, it's not. So those would be the two teams I'd watch as maybe surprise teams to trade up. Question number four from Adam Showalter. That's at Adam Showalter. Why doesn't Jadeveon Clowney have a bigger market, and who is actually in place for his services still? I think he winds up back in Seattle, Adam. And the reason why he doesn't have a bigger market, I think there are two reasons why. Number one, I think his financial expectations were a little much. He expected to be paid like DeMarcus Lawrence and Frank Clark and all those guys last offseason. And I think he could make the case that, you know, in a lot of points in his career, he was better players than those guys. He's a better player than those guys. But if you're asking for more than $20 million, it's just based on the environment right now, it's a tough thing to ask. Teams projected the cap being higher than it wound up being. And here's the big thing. If you're going to make that sort of investment, we talked about this with Cam, and you're bringing in a guy with injury history, you're going to want to bring him in for a physical. You're going to want to take a look at him. And they haven't had the teams haven't had the chance to take a look at him physically. And so I think the most likely scenario is he winds up going back to Seattle, and maybe he winds up going back to Seattle on a one-year deal. Question number five from Ricker81. That's at D_Ricker81. Hypothetically, if the season does not happen, would the draft order remain the same for 2021? I believe it would. Also, any movement on Yannick or Trent Williams trades? So we talked about Trent Williams earlier. I think the Trent Williams trade happens if his contract demands come down. If he's so desperate to get out of D.C., then maybe he's willing to take a little less on a contract. If he's willing to take a little less on a contract, I think all of a sudden there'd be a good market for him on the trade front. As for Yannick, Yannick's an interesting case because I think you have to slot him probably somewhere between – you slot him somewhere between where you had Frank Clark and Dee Ford last year. Frank Clark went for a 1 and a 2. Dee Ford went for 2 2s. Why the difference? Well, because Dee Ford actually went for 1 2. Dee Ford went for a 2 because he isn't as good a run defender. Frank Clark's a more well-rounded player. Yannick's a little bit more like Dee Ford in that sense. A very, very good pass rusher, kind of an ordinary run defender. And so do teams look at it and say, this guy's worth a 2? If he's worth a 2, does Jacksonville move him for a 2?
And what's he asking for contractually? That's going to be part of the equation too. Dee Ford took a fairly team-friendly deal last year to go to San Francisco. And so all of those things sort of play in where what's he asking for in the contract and where's that middle ground between what Kansas City got for Dee Ford, what Seattle got for Frank Clark last year. Obviously, both those moves worked out to a degree. Both those teams, San Francisco and Kansas City, that traded for those players wound up in the Super Bowl. Yannick's just, I mean, to me, if you can get a first-round pick for him, if you're willing to give up a first-round pick for him, the deal, you make the deal happen. Finally, question number six from GM Wannabe. That's at GM Wannabe. What are the Vikings planning to do with the cap space from Hunter's contract restructuring? I don't think the Vikings are going to do anything big. They've got the draft capital now after the Stephon Diggs trade where they're going to be able to address needs on the offensive and defensive lines and the receiver position based on what's available in this year's class, like somewhere along the line in April. And so I think they'll be able to do those things. Where this could make a difference is if you do want to keep Anthony Harris. And it was a surprise to Anthony Harris and his people that they were tagged. The Vikings made room for Anthony Harris's tag by doing a new deal with Kirk Cousins. There's just, right now, I think more than anything else, this was about creating breathing room in general. They needed to create breathing room for Harris's tag. They needed to create breathing room for their rookie class when the rookie class comes in. And now they're going to have two first-round picks, so they're going to need room for that. So it's just, I think part of this is just normal accounting because they were in a tight spot coming into the offseason. And if anybody benefits from this, you know, monetarily, then I think it'll probably be somebody who's on the roster right now, somebody like Anthony Harris. So that was six questions, but I do have a bonus question here from my buddy Fitz. That's Ian Fitzsimmons at Ian Fitz ESPN, the host of Freddie and Fitzsimmons on ESPN Radio. Personal friend of mine. If you could go to one place to eat in any NFL city, where would you feast and what are you ordering? You know what? I'm going to kiss your ass here, Fitz, because I know you're from there. I think this is probably what you were doing. You were probably fishing for a compliment for your city anyway, but there's no question it's got to be New Orleans. I'd go to Herb Saint New Orleans. I'd have to look at the menu again to know what I'd order. I think they had a tremendous salmon there. I can't remember what I like, but there were so many good things on the menu there, and I've been there a bunch. So give me Herb Saint New Orleans. Appreciate all you guys coming out. I hope that we can give you guys some entertainment here as, you know, this just bizarre, different, unique, like challenging situation for all of us unfolds in our country. Everybody, listen to doctors. Pay attention to the science. Stay home if you can. If you take all, we're all in this together. If you can take care of what you take, if you can take care of what they're asking you to take care of, we'll all get through it quicker. I do believe that. And it's not because of something I know. It's because I trust what I hear from doctors. Again, we're all in this together. So I hope everybody can kind of listen to what the people who know what they're talking about are talking about. Appreciate you guys coming out again. Like I said, hopefully we give you guys a little bit of a diversion here as everything gets weird and different and tough. And I want you guys also, if you want some more diversions, to pay attention to all of our podcasts. So we got the Monday morning podcast. We've got the Weekside podcast with Jenny and Connor. You can get all of our podcasts, all three of those podcasts, this one and those two, on the MMQB NFL podcast feed. You can also get the MMQB NFL news feed, which catches you up on everything that's going on in the NFL every day. Both those feeds are on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts. Wherever you guys get your shows, you can get those two shows. Have them pop right in your podcast feed every time they go up. Same time next week. I'll see you guys then.